is going to be a few minutes late this morning. We have two members that have asked to be excused, that being Chief Stratton and Chief Burbank. So we do have a quorum here this morning that will allow us to proceed. With that, I would like to welcome everybody that is in attendance today to this meeting of the Post Council. Our first item of business will be the approval of the March 27th minutes. If you've all had a chance to review those, I'll entertain a motion. Okay, do we have a second? Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, at this time we're going to turn the time over to Mr. Bolander for open meeting training.
All right, good morning, members of the board. It's that time of year again, long summer days, warm temperatures, and open and public meeting NACS training. So in the past two times we've done this, we end up having kind of a fairly robust discussion about records and all that. And I think that's a good thing, because I think it's when you start thinking, when you're not thinking about these issues and like, oh, well, this doesn't apply to us or anything, that's when you start getting in trouble. So I think that's a good thing. Hopefully I'll be a little bit more brief this time. What I've done is, as I've gone through the Open Meetings Act, I've kind of wanted to highlight certain areas I think that are relevant to this board, and just sort of questions to kind of keep in mind as we have our meetings. When you really break down the act, there's kind of three parts. There's requirements that happened before the meeting, requirements during the meeting, and requirements after the meeting. I'm going to be spending most of my time kind of in that middle thing about sort of the issues that kind of pop up during the meeting, and then just kind of quickly touch on some of the few other things as well. Obviously, the whole point of the Open and Public Meetings Act is to have open meetings for the public, so that way the public can come in, the idea being the public can come in and see how this council conducts its business. And with some very few exceptions, which we'll talk about, these meetings are open and public. Just two quick definitions just to kind of throw out there. Yes, this council here meets the definition of a public body. Just something as sort of a FYI, if I know a lot of you serve on other committees and boards, there's been a new addition. There was a legislative change which added something called a specified body. And I mean, it's more directed towards kind of task forces and kind of committees with the legislature. But if you happen to sit on one of those committees where there is a legislator, you might just want to keep that in mind. Anyway, I just want to bring that up for your information. The other definition I want to talk about was like the definition of a meeting. Like, obviously, this is a meeting. And basically, it's because you have a quorum, and you're here to discuss or act on something that's within this council's authority. One clarification the legislature made this year is they changed the slight definition where in the act it does state that chance or social gatherings, that's the word, they changed it from meetings to gathering, just to kind of clarify. So like a chance or social gathering does not mean a meeting. So if a majority of you decide afterwards to go out to lunch somewhere, or, you know, go hit the golf course just south of here, that's not a meeting. But if you do that and you start discussing matters that are on the agenda and matters that are pending before the council, then that's where you start getting into trouble. And so I think it's just sort of a balance between, you know, just because you happen to bump into each other somewhere or having some sort of social gathering doesn't mean it's a meeting, but you can't use the social gathering as an excuse to kind of skirt around the open meetings law. As far as requirements before the meeting, this is probably more directed towards the staff, but essentially the requirement is to give notice. And that's kind of obvious, because the public can't be there if they don't know when the meeting is and what you're discussing. And so notice, it's a minimum 24 hours notice. Notices given through the Utah Public Notice website, and then posting a copy of the agenda actually here at post headquarters, just, you know, sticking it on the window somewhere in the building. Meeting, and usually what the meeting has, it, you know, obviously has, you know, details like time and place of the meeting and the agenda items, what's going to be discussed, so that way the public knows what the council is going to be talking about. One exception is for emergency meetings. The 4 years I've been with the AG's office, I've actually never seen a council or a board actually invoke and have an emergency meeting. This council only meets four times a year, so I don't think it's really an issue for you, but that is an option if there's an emergency or like an urgent matter that just can't wait, and it can't wait for the 24 hours notice. The board can meet under limited circumstances. They have to put in their minutes why they couldn't comply with the, you know, 24 hours requirement, and then, you know, just basically do their best to comply beyond that. One other issue I want to bring up as far as notice is electronic meetings. This is where we have a council member who would like to participate by phone and participate in the voting and things like that. The law does require us to have an administrative rule in place to allow that. DPS is currently working on sort of a department-wide rule that would cover all the boards and councils. That hasn't been enacted yet, but it's in the works. So what I want to touch upon next is kind of the issues during the meeting, and this is going to be the closed meetings, when the council needs to close the meetings. General rule is you can't do it with some very few exceptions, and they're listed in the statute. I think out of the exceptions listed, I think I counted three that are going to be most likely apply to this board. The first one is discussing an individual's character, professional competence, or physical or mental health, investigative proceedings regarding allegations of criminal misconduct, and then deliberations of an adjudicative body. Now, this one actually isn't in code, but the courts have recognized it. That's basically if the council feels like they need to deliberate this in private and just kind of speak candidly amongst each other, they can close the meeting for that. Just keep in mind that any fact-finding has to be done in public, and the vote has to be done in public. As far as closing the meeting, has to be for one of those should be one of those three reasons. There's some other ones, but I don't think they really apply to this council. Two-thirds vote, and we have to record who voted in favor of going to close the meeting. And keep in mind, once in closed meeting, you can only discuss the topic or the reason it was closed. And that sometimes that can be kind of inadvertent, where you'll have a council or a board going to closed session to talk about an issue, and it just sort of gradually creeps into like other issues. Like, we just need to make sure to, you know, stay on task for the specific reason it was closed. The other thing I'd point about closed meetings is the meeting always starts in open. There's no such thing as like a meeting that's entirely closed. All meetings always begin openly and then go into closed session. Now, requirements, the last thing I'm going to touch on is requirements kind of after the meeting. And this really goes kind of to the minutes and the records. We're required by law to record the meeting and take minutes, or we're allowed to take minutes, but we're required to at least record it, which we do both. I would point out, this includes the open and closed sessions of a meeting. The one exception is if the council goes into closed session to discuss a person's competence or physical or mental health. That part of the meeting does not need to be recorded, but what we have is the chair sign an affidavit saying that's why we went into closed session. Generally, the recordings and minutes are public records, with the exception of the portions that are closed. Those are classified as protected records, which basically means somebody would have to get in court order to release that information. There are certain deadline requirements as far as posting approved minutes and pending minutes. As far as I've seen, you know, we're meeting those. The only other issue I'd bring up is just one more legislative change, which isn't a big deal, but it's big enough a deal to just kind of mention it. now included in the act is if somebody appears before this council and they provide some sort of information, whether hard copy or electronic, basically they are basically the council has to ask them for a copy of that to include in the record. I mean, when you think about it, it's already the general practice. It's just codifying something that most committees and boards are doing anyway. It's just that if someone's going to present something, then they need to give a copy to the council. So pretty straightforward. So that's all I really have unless there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bolander. It's always a pleasure to go through that training on a yearly basis. It keeps us out of trouble, though. All right, next agenda item is post-policy update. Deputy Director Sparks.
Thank you, Chief Keefe, members of the council. Just wanted to give you a briefing on the revisions of the post policy. As the need for changes to policy come up throughout the year, those policy changes are made. And then at the end of the year, on an annual basis, those are incorporated into the main body of the policy, and we provide a report to the council as to the changes that have been made the following or the previous year. So there have been a number of changes that I'll highlight today. Those changes are available to you on the council portal on the post website, and the entire version of the new 2014 policy is also available to you at that location. The first policy is investigative procedures for employee violations. This is a new aspect of policy. What this policy covers is the administrative and investigative procedures should a certified officer who is a post employee become the subject of a post investigation. The policy for admittance to post-sponsored basic training programs to the Academy has had a number of revisions. As you are all, I believe, aware, our application for attending the Basic Training Academy is now done completely online, and so there have been a few policy changes to facilitate that. As we collect the information online, that application is good for 1 year. We find that cadets who attend satellite academies in particular sometimes fill those applications out quite some time in advance. And because we don't have the ability to collect a signature on the electronic form, we have a procedure where at the beginning of the academy, a member of the staff will go to that academy, will conduct a training session where we talk about the requirements of the application, what's required to be put on the application, and we do a fairly thorough job of educating the cadets so that they make sure that all of the requirements of that application are covered. At that point, we also have them sign a form verifying that the information that's contained in their electronic application is still current and valid, give them the opportunity to make any updates. And so policy has been revised to accommodate that. Probably one of the larger revisions in the policy also comes in that section, and that is clarifying the waiting periods for prescription drug use. As we have reviewed the misuse of prescription drugs year after year, it's always been a difficult thing. There are just a large number of circumstances, mitigating and aggravating circumstances involved in that. And so what we've done in that section of policy is create some clarification and some guidelines. We've developed a matrix so that applicants will know exactly what they're being held to. Waiting periods will apply. Satellite academy directors will know, and of course agencies will know. We also have some changes to the academy assessments. This was a fairly minor change in the curriculum. We elected to spread the ethics training out throughout the academy. Previously, most of it was at the front of the academy. We wanted to spread that out so that the cadets would be exposed to that ethics training throughout the academy. And so that policy change really just establishes what classes will be tested in which sessions. There's also a change to the firearms qualification requirements. This is not really a change in policy, just a clarification. Clarifies the number of retesting opportunities a cadet will have if that cadet fails the certification shoot. Basically, it gives them the opportunity for four tests. There is the opportunity, if they fail the original test, There's an opportunity to test and retest, remediation, and then another opportunity for a test and retest. Then the final policy revision was some revisions to our resident storm policy. Again, this is not a change in procedure, simply some clarification, updating the language, and making sure that it's the policy is more understandable. Again, all of those policies have been incorporated into the 2014 version of the post-policy manual, and that is available to you as council members on the post-council portal. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Director Sparks. Any discussion on the policy changes? Seeing none, we'll move to the next agenda item. Lieutenant Acosta, are you going, or is Lieutenant Brewer? You got
it? I get to go first.
Oh, okay.
Mine's going to be short. Members of council, ladies and gentlemen in attendance, just like to give you a brief report on what we've done since the last post-council meeting. We have received a total of 50 complaints into our office. Of those 50 complaints, we have opened 23 investigations. Of the remainder, we're still waiting for information to come in via subpoena or the grandma request. We have had one administrative hearing before a law judge. We have closed three of the cases without taking any action whatsoever. So that was investigations start to finish and no action taken. We have received four voluntary relinquishments. They include one specifically for Garrity alone, another one for perjury, falsifying a police report, and Garrity violation, another one for possession of controlled substance, and the last one, theft and possession of controlled substance. Our officers have done 174 background investigations for people who attend the academy, and we currently have 69 investigations that are currently active. Any questions? Short and sweet, sir.
You kept your word. It was short. Thank
I
you,
did.
Al.
Less than a minute. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Lieutenant Brewer, Satellite Academy audit, please.
On the agenda, is there a quarterly report for training as well? Okay, I'll do that first. This quarter, we've graduated and started two classes. So session 306 graduated April 18th with 35 law enforcement officers. They certified 38. And session 307, which is going to graduate tomorrow here at Post, is going to, we're going to graduate and certify 18 cadets. That's if they pass their exam today. And 308, session 308 has started SFO and now is currently this week just began their law enforcement block with 32 cadets. So that's a very full class for us. In the in-service training, we administered 19 in-service training classes this quarter, training 395 officers and dispatchers for a total of 468 hours of training delivered. Any questions regarding the basic training or the in-service training? I do have a breakdown of courses, but it's quite lengthy. So if there are no questions regarding the report, I could move into the next agenda item.
Please do.
Okay. Two Satellite Academy reports were conducted this quarter, Weber County, this was Weber State Academy, along with Bridgerland Academy, were both conducted, and no exceptions to these satellite audits were found. One side note was that a discussion took place regarding pepper spray certification during the BCO portion of the training, and that that came up because of a question whether or not a certain type or a certain brand of pepper spray certification should be used versus another. So, for instance, in the curriculum, a DefTech, and I got the clarification just prior to this meeting, if a DefTech instructor uses or is certified with that brand name goes ahead and delivers the training, does that mean that that individual who receives the training can't go and work at an agency or use that certification that uses a Sabre brand? And so in looking at the training curriculum, it looks like it's generic. So the curriculum is delivered in a generic manner. So they go through the training, they do everything in a generic way, and then the certification is also generic. Then that individual can go back to the agency, and if they need to certify on a DefTech or a Sabre brand or any other brand, so to speak, then that agency can take care of that certification. So that question just came up of how are we supposed to deliver this, and so I said as long as you stick to the curriculum, you're going to be fine with that. So any questions regarding the satellite audits specifically regarding Weber State or Bridgerland Applied Technology?
It just seems that as we conduct these audits, the academies are doing a much better job in coming in compliance with the audit requirements.
That is correct.
Might as well continue, Wade. You're next up on the agenda.
Okay, thank you. I just need to grab one piece of paperwork. If I could just refer the council to the document that's titled Proposed Special Function Officer Curriculum. We'll review that first. Then underneath that is the Law Enforcement Officer Curriculum. Just walk you through this. As you recall from the last post-council meeting, we dedicated to you that we were going to go back and look at mental health training. And so what we've done is we've created a mental health block. This was under the advisement of the curriculum board. And so the way we wanted to approach this was to, since Utah uses the crisis intervention training as a certification for advanced training in officers, we felt like what we needed to do is base everything that we do in the basic academy under that model. So we went back and we've created, if you'll see on page 2, this mental health block of training, a course of classes, first one being titled Understanding Human Behavior and Mental Illness. This is basically the introduction that teaches cadets understanding, some definitions of what mental health is, and this is all based upon the CIT model. Then we go into this introduction of the crisis intervention team, which was currently found in the law enforcement block, and we brought that over into the special function officer block. That was normally 4 hours, but we felt like since that 4-hour block included the same definitions and the same topics that were covered in the first half of that class, we could reduce that by an hour. So that's now 3 hours. And then this 8-hour course, which was response to the mental health crisis, basically walks an individual through What are the types of calls and incidents that officers are going to see, and then here's how you respond to them. And then the final couple hours of this class is going to be scenario training. Now, traditionally, we have not done scenario training in the SFO block, where the cadets are going to interact with some role players and actually conduct scenario training. In the basic correctional officer block, there is some scenario training, and we're going to kind of model what we do in the SFO block on what they are doing, and that's we're not sure if we're going to be able to go full force on force, but it's just going to be this interaction of the trainees with actual role players, and we feel like that's going to be very beneficial. And then also, we kept this management and recognition of the excited delirium in this mental health block. It was currently in the special functions block as a patrol class, and we felt like it does fit into the mental health block of training. So you can see if you take what the hours that we're currently into there, we have increased the mental health training by about 12 or 13 hours in the special functions block. One more change. Due to some overlapping of training between the BCO block and the LEO block, We felt like if we took the introduction to the incident command system and that national incident command system, those 6 hours from the LEO block and brought them back into the SFO block, then a trainee that's going through all three blocks of training doesn't have to redo that 6 hours in the BCO block. Because currently, if they went through the SFO and BCO, they would still have to do that. Or I guess they would just provide that training and say that they've conducted that or they've completed that. But we felt that was a redundancy that we could fix and just bring into the SFO block. And that's all done online. So before I move on to the law enforcement block of training, any questions regarding SFO? Okay, the next portion is this law enforcement block, and you can see the hours and the changes that we did there. They're just lined through, and it shows where those hours came from, the introduction to the incident command, and, of course, the introduction to the crisis intervention team. Those were now moved into down back to the SFO. So that's really the only change that we are making the recommendations for, the LEO block, which actually reduces the hours by about 10, almost a full day. It is a full day. So before we you vote on this, I would like to just reference these two handouts that have the curriculum that we've developed with the subcommittee, and I would like to thank Dr. Checkitz. I've been talking with him on the phone, emailing him back and forth, emailing the curriculum subcommittee group, to make sure that we're on the right track for this, and have got back a lot of feedback. So I would invite Dr. Checkitz and the subcommittee, if they felt like they wanted to make comments regarding this, to go ahead and jump in. Basically, this mental health, it looks like it might be just a little bit, you might have to just flip it over. The way it was stapled, that's actually the first page. So flip it over and it will be Understanding Human Behavior and Mental Healthness is the MHT 1010. This looks like the copier stapled that. And it'll just give you an overview of what we're trying to accomplish with this course goal and the course direction. And I will note that we did recommend that these classes be taught by those officers who understand mental illness best, and that is the CIT certified officers across the state, in conjunction with mental health providers. We feel like if they want to team teach this class, that would probably be the best way to deliver it. Across the state, most law enforcement agencies have created a relationship with the mental health facilities where they are taking people and using them for treatment on individuals that need to do that, and hopefully diverting them into these mental health facilities versus booking them into jail if that meets the requirements. You know, of course, if they haven't committed some type of crime that requires them to be jailed. So it's our hope that the satellite academies and across the state would utilize those individuals from these facilities to teach these classes and deliver them. So as you review this curriculum, I would just open it up for any kind of questions, comments, concerns. Just as early as last week, I was approached by the crisis intervention team group that's administered out of the Salt Lake City Police Department, and their concern was that there was a big push to go to a class that is titled, it just slipped my mind, but it has something to do with first aid mental health. And there is a company out there that's pushing it. It's actually pretty good curriculum, but unfortunately, it's not modeled after the CIT model. And the thing that really turns us off of that is they want to charge a significant amount per head to go through this training. And so we're not funded to be able to pay for every single cadet that goes through that training. So that's why we're probably most likely not going to be supporting that. Any questions or comments? Go ahead, Dr. Checkitz.
Just be that, you know, I'm very supportive of this from an educational perspective. The CIT training is training, and it's directed very specifically for officers in the field. I think this is educational and gives kind of a foundational perspective for cadets, and so I just feel like it's a good place to start.
Thank you. And thank you for all the good input that you've given us through this process.
All right. I'd like to express my appreciation of the subcommittee that's worked on this. I do have to say that I am disappointed that we were not able to facilitate the incorporation of the CIT program into the academy as when this was first introduced, the council actually requested that we go that way. But the realities of coordinating an additional 40 hours with the mental health providers that participate in training this class obviously have made that, I don't want to say impossible, but difficult to achieve. And it appears that this is a good compromise in getting this. The unfortunate part about this is, as law enforcement administrators, it's incumbent upon us now to certify our officers in crisis intervention training when they come back to our departments because of the growing mental health crisis that we're all facing. And I would much rather have seen that done in the basic academy than in-service training, but this appears to be a compromise. Another thing that Lieutenant Brewer that you said that caught my attention, dealing with the satellite academies, I think that the council should consider mandating that the satellite academies utilize the same level of staff that the main academy does when it comes to CIT training, that being certified CIT trainers, law enforcement officer trainers, as well as the mental health providers that are used by the main academy. And speaking with Director Stevenson, that is something that we as the council can mandate on the satellite academies, and my personal opinion is we should. So, given that, is there any other discussion regarding the curriculum changes outlined by Lieutenant Brewer? Okay, we'll need a motion to adopt these changes.
Would you like a motion on what we just discussed as well?
I would. I think it could just be one big motion covering all aspects of it. Don't you agree? Okay.
Sure. I'll make the motion that we adopt the proposed changes to the curriculum with the caveat that we require the satellite academies to use the same instructors, is what you said, as the postings for the CIT training.
Or the same certified. Right? Same certified. They're not going to be able to use the same.
Same certification.
Yes.
Instructors with the same level of certification.
Both law enforcement and mental health.
Right.
Okay.
That's second.
Very clear motion.
Yeah,
seconded,
very clear.
Seconded by Sheriff Smith. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Lieutenant Brewer. And again, I do appreciate the work that you and the subcommittee did on coming up with this curriculum change in a very important aspect of law enforcement.
It is, and just for a side note discussion, I foresee this curriculum as being new training and as new techniques and tactics come out, we're not closed to continuing to bolster these objectives and to reevaluate them on an ongoing basis. So for instance, if the CIT group comes to us and says, you know what, we feel like this objective needs to be in here, I would imagine that we would want to incorporate that in there and then advise the council, this is what's been brought to us, do you agree with this, and of course keep you in the loop regarding any kind of further changes and as we implement this curriculum, because we foresee that maybe some hours might need to be tweaked a little bit, or something is missing from it, or something just needs to be changed as we go through and implement it.
I think you'd have the concurrence of the council, Lieutenant.
Just as a discussion regarding the special functions officer block of training, BCO block of training, law enforcement officer block of training, as we've reviewed this curriculum, we've recognized that nowhere in the statute does it require, or could we find that it requires, somebody who is attending BCO training to go to SFO training. And so what we've done, or what we would like to do, just notify the council of this, is to review all three blocks of training. Because what the practice is that somebody that's attending the BCO block has always gone to the SFO block. So if a sheriff's department or the Department of Corrections employs a correctional officer, they always send them the special functions officer training first, and then they go into the BCO block. And then some even continue on to the LEO block, because there are sheriff's departments that have all three certifications. So maybe they might be able to use those who work in the jail and put them out on the road, and vice versa. So with that thinking and with that practice in mind, we felt like that what we need to do is maybe analyze the curriculum so that SFO is a building block for the BCO and the LEO blocks. So, for instance, if a person comes in and takes the SFO training, that's a building block for LEO if they're going to continue on as a law enforcement officer, and it's a building block for the BCO block. And so what we need to do is analyze that BCO block of training and identify if there's any redundancy, and look at those objectives very closely to see if there's something that needs to be taken out of that and put into the SFO block. If it benefits all of law enforcement, then we feel like maybe that needs to just go into the SFO block. So what we have done to start this is to work with the Department of Corrections, and we have made the curriculums, Major Turley is going to be presenting his curriculum here in a minute, and you'll see that, to make it look like it's uniform across all three certifications, so the curriculum looks the same. If you'll recall, in years past, it looks a little bit different in the formatting, it looks a little bit different in the numbering. Now we have numbers that are all sequential across all three certifications. So that's been the first step. The second step will then be to review the content, and then we will make recommendations to the council for any changes that we feel like need to occur.
If I can add, we've already started doing that based upon the changes. We've identified some valuable training in BCO that all law enforcement in the mental health area could benefit from. So we've moved it to the SFO, which you have approved. So we've already started that ball rolling. We just want to take it further, make sure that all objectives are enabling objectives like we have in our SFO and LEO. We found that the SFO was more geared towards law enforcement and not so much towards corrections. So we want to find that balance between the two. So there are building blocks leading into both certifications.
Any questions or concerns regarding that direction that we would like to take?
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry, sir.
I want to steal your thunder. We are going to engender the Department of Corrections and the sheriffs as we formulate this SFO and BCO to make sure that all parties are involved, because ultimately those are the customers that receive that certification from this body and post.
Thank you, Lieutenant Brewer.
Thank you.
All right, our next agenda item is correction training curriculum. Major Turley.
Council. My name is Spencer Turley. I'm one of the training managers for the Department of Corrections. Let me just start off by excusing our training director, Kirk Christensen. He's out of town and asked that I fill in for him, but he's sorry he couldn't be here. In your packet, you'll have a memo that's directed to the council from Director Christensen that I'd like to go through and answer any questions and present here for just a second. So for the past several months, the Department of Corrections Training Academy staff, in conjunction with POST and in conjunction with our Curriculum Advisory Board, which consists primarily of our instructors in the academy, as well as the county sheriff personnel who send cadets through our academy. In addition to the county sheriff personnel, we'll also have the satellite academies who are teaching the BCO block. We also get all of their input. So in conjunction with everybody, we've come up with a number of different recommendations here for this morning. The first one that Lieutenant Brewer just mentioned is the format and structure of the BCO block. So the format and structure previously was based off of solely Department of Corrections policy, and as POST changed some of what they were doing with doing away with quizzes and incorporating intermediate tests, our policy and their policy didn't really jive anymore. And so we've worked with POST, and we've come up with a format change to the BCO block that will now reflect the SFO and the LEO blocks of training. A couple of those are highlighted in the memo. The first thing that we went through and did is change the layout and the appearance of the objectives. That was simply just a reformatting to make them look differently, but so that as the cadets looked at the objectives as they advanced from one block to another, they were looking at something that looked consistently, rather than trying to learn a new format. We also went through and changed all the numbers of our objectives. So our objectives generally started previously with a 200 series, which is similar to what the LEO block was using. And so to avoid any confusion there, we bumped the BCO block objectives to a 3,000 series numbers, just to make them easier to read. We also recommend incorporating the BCO block into the POST policy, so there's no longer a Department of Corrections, this is how we're going to run it, and a POST, this is how we're going to run it, that weren't really matching. And so to incorporate our testing procedures and the other procedures of the BCO block into the POST policy so that it's consistent across the board would make things a whole lot easier, especially when it comes to the testing. So you'll notice there on the last two bullet points that we recommend adding two intermediate tests to the BCO block and doing away with the correctional law and offender rights written test and the reasonable force written test. What that will do for us is the CLOR test, the correctional law and offender rights test, and the reasonable force test, all of that material will still be tested on, but it will be tested in a broader sense in the intermediate test where we'll incorporate a few of the other classes that are taught into those intermediate tests. It won't just be a subject-specific test. So we do away with those two tests, but still keep two tests there that will cover a broader range of subjects. If you'll turn to the second attachment there, you'll see, it'll probably be four pages back. You'll see a list of objectives. Some of them are color-coded. There's yellow and there's green. The yellow ones will be the classes that are taught primarily up front in the BCO block, and they will be covered on the intermediate test one. Most of those are legal-based so that they get the good legal base of the corrections block as they move into some of the other foundational classes. And then the green classes will be taught and then tested on in their intermediate test number two. And the other classes that aren't highlighted are either practical tests where it's scenario-based, or they will be tested on the certification test. So that's how we broke down the two intermediate tests as far as what would be incorporated into the POST policy. Is there any questions on the format and structure? The other thing, if you'll turn to the second page, there's one that looks the same as the colored one, but not colored. This is what the finished product, in essence, would look like as far as the restructuring and the reformatting to make it look like the SFO and the LEO blocks of training. Moving on to the second bullet point there, with the classes moved to the SFO block. So currently in the BCO block, we have 15 hours of CIT and mental health-related training. As we talked with Lieutenant Brewer and the other POST staff concerning the CIT training, we provided them a copy of our curriculum. They looked at it and reviewed it and felt that everything that we were covering will now be covered in the SFO block, and so to reduce the redundancy of training, we're going to remove that 15 hours from the BCO block as it will now be covered in the SFO block. Just as a point of discussion that Lieutenant Brewer made as far as who's teaching the class, as far as the corrections block, the people that we have teach the class are our CIT-related, or our CIT-certified staff, and then our mental health doctors and providers from the prison. And so as far as the way we've been teaching, it will be right in line with the motion that the council just passed. The one thing I will say is, has been said by many, with prisons and jails becoming the de facto mental health institutions around the country, if by some chance we get feedback that the new curriculum, as Lieutenant Brewer mentioned, doesn't meet the needs and we need to update it, we'll definitely come back to the council even as soon as the next council meeting and say, here's kind of what we're thinking, where we're missing, and go from there. And if what we're missing is more related to a correctional environment than it is a streets environment, we can look at incorporating some of these classes back into the BCO block. But we'll kind of play that by ear as we go. At this point, though, it looks like our needs will be met with the new SFO curriculum. On the back page there of the memo, the first thing there says class deletions. One of the classes that the only class we recommend taking out of the BCO block this time is a class that we've called Correctional Terminology and Operational Guidelines. It's been a one-hour class. I tend to refer to it as a dictionary class. We've come up with five or six pages of words that we put definitions to, so that if a cadet has a question about what is a sally port or what is a cuff port or what is the Board of Pardons, that it's that they can go to and reference it. We found in teaching the class, though, that as they toured different facilities around the state, or as instructors have taught, they've explained the concepts and the class is, again, just redundant. So we'd like to remove the class as far as teaching goes, but still provide them with the objective, so if they have a question, they can reference the terms and have their questions answered. It just won't be taught in a formal class, if that makes sense. And then the other two that we recommend are class changes. The first one there is we'd like to add an hour to our correctional ethics and professionalism class. So there's a number of classes already in the SFO block that cover ethics. The correctional ethics class that we tend to cover are more correction-specific things as far as nothing in and nothing out of a facility and what that means, nothing to and nothing from an offender and what that means, and corrections-related topics. The hour we'd like to add will be used to cover social media issues in the work environment. We've done a number of different things as far as social media goes with the corrections block. One of the things that we've done is we have a staff offender relations class, and as part of that we bring role players in as inmates, but the cadets are under the impression at the time the inmates come in that they're actual inmates. And before the role players come in, we have them do a little research and find out what they can about a staff member that's in the class on social media. They look on Facebook, they look on Twitter, they look wherever they can and collect information. And then as they come in, they pick out one of the cadets in the class and say, I think I went to high school with you, or I know where you live. You have this in your front yard. I used to just live down the street from you. And the cadet kind of goes into panic mode for a second. And then we reveal to the cadet that we found all this online on Facebook or social media about you, and it's kind of a reality check for them. So we'd like to incorporate that in a little bit. The other thing that we have found is on a national level as well as a local level, there's been a number of officers that have posted inappropriate things on Facebook, whether that's been case-sensitive information or it's been a correctional or officer in a jail or a prison that's made a comment about an inmate suicide or an attempted suicide that was just completely unprofessional and inappropriate. So we want to take an extra hour in that ethics and professionalism class and talk about some of these issues that are plaguing almost all of law enforcement, but we would address them to a correction-specific agenda. So that would be the hour that we would add on there. And then the other class we'd like to reduce by 1 hour, the inmate discipline class, to take from 2 hours to 1 hour. Inmate discipline is something that every correctional facility in the country deals with. And looking at our curriculum, though, we realize that almost an hour of the class dealt with Department of Corrections-specific policies as far as timelines that we deal with disciplining offenders or writing reports that wasn't applicable to officers throughout the state. So to make the curriculum, in essence, more generic so it's applicable to everybody, we'd like to reduce that class from 2 hours to 1 hour and have it taught that way. So in a nutshell, if the council approves these recommendations, the BCO block training hours would go from 188 hours down to 172 hours. The biggest chunk of that would obviously be the 15 hours from the CIT-related training that will be incorporated into the SFO block. The one last note that I'll make is with the addition of two intermediate tests, we've gone through and we've updated our objectives to make them more of, as Lieutenant Brewer referred to, more of an enabling objective so that we can drive the test questions that we need from them so that we can have those two intermediate tests. So just to give you an example, as far as one of the objectives might have said something like, the cadet will understand what a security threat group is. But there was very little explanation about that. So we've gone in and defined what a security threat group is and how it relates to a correctional environment so that a test question can be derived from that objective. So we have updated the objectives fairly substantially, but the core curriculum of the objectives didn't really change at all. There's just further explanations that are in there. So that's what we'd like to do with the corrections block at this point in time. Is there any questions I can answer? Sir?
So is this going to make the course 2 days less than
correct it will be 2 days less, but then the SFO will in essence be 2 days longer, so the amount of training time is almost sixes.
If I could add something, just report to the council, Major Turley and the staff have been awesome to work with. They've been very amenable and open to the changes, and we both want the same goal in mind, so I just wanted to compliment them and Director Cook and his leadership. I think the relationship has never been better, and we've been working really closely with them. So thank them.
Thank you. We enjoy our relationship with them as well. Any other questions or feedback for us?
Okay, thank you, Major. We'll bring it back to the council for a motion or discussion.
I'll make a motion.
Thank you, Colonel. Okay, thanks, Colonel. Thank you, Dr. Whaley. Okay, we have a motion to adopt the recommended the curriculum. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that brings us to our next agenda item, which is the disciplinary cases. Mr. Yockey, the Attorney General's office, will present these cases this morning.
Good morning, council members. So we'll jump right into this. The first matter today is the certification of Brandel D. Bexel. The sustained allegations are assault, domestic violence, and lying under Garrity, which falls under Category A of the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action regarding this is revocation. And a summary of the facts are as follows. On February 7th, 2013, Bexel was arrested by a local police department for domestic violence involving his wife. During the post-investigation, two other domestic violence incidents were discovered. Post conducted two Garrity interviews with Bexel, in which he adamantly denied ever striking, hitting, or kicking his wife. Bexel submitted to a polygraph examination and showed deceptive when asked if he had ever hit his wife in anger with a closed fist. After the polygraph examination, Post conducted a third Garrity interview with Bexel. Bexel admitted that in 2010, he punched his wife only one time in the arm after she punched him in the mouth. Bexel also admitted that on February 5th, 2012, he grabbed his wife's foot when she tried to kick him, but denied injuring her toes. On March 19th, 2013, the prosecuting attorney declined to prosecute in this matter, and criminal charges of assault were dismissed. Brandon Bexel failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and on March 18, 2014, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Officer Cadet Bexel.
Anyone have any questions? Is Mr. Bexel or a representative for Mr. Bexel here that would like to address the council? Okay, bring it back to the council for a vote or a motion. I'm ahead of myself. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Check. It's Sheriff Edmonds. Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
The next matter for the post council to hear is the certification of Blake A. Day, former member of the Unified Police Department. Sustained allegations are possession of controlled substance, theft, retail theft, falsely obtaining and dispensing prescription drugs, impersonating a police officer, and a BCI violation. With all these offenses, they fall under the categories of A, B, and C of the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is revocation. A summary of the facts are as follows. On May 3, 2012, Post initiated an investigation into the allegations of Blake Day misusing the Bureau of Criminal Identification information. Post conducted a Garrity interview with Day, during which he admitted to using BCI records to help his girlfriend locate information she requested. During the investigation, Post also discovered Day was being investigated by the Utah Department of Public Safety for impersonating a police officer and felony possession of a controlled substance. During a Garrity interview with Post, Day admitted to identifying himself as a peace officer and providing police identification during a traffic stop. On June 28, 2012, Day resigned from the Unified Police Department and was not employed as a certified police officer at the time of the traffic stop on November 8, 2012. Day later pled guilty to impersonating the police officer, Class B misdemeanor, and falsely obtaining / dispensing a prescription drug, a third-degree felony. During their investigation, Post also discovered Day had five additional criminal cases pending. The following is a list of convictions resulting from those criminal cases. On May 31st, 2013, Day was stopped and arrested for retail theft at a wholesale store. On January 7th, 2014, Day pled guilty to retail theft as provided in by Utah Code Annotated 766602, a Class A misdemeanor, which was later amended to a Class B misdemeanor. On July 2nd, 2013, Day was identified as a suspect in retail theft. A warrant was subsequently issued for his arrest. He was arrested for the warrant on July 30th, 2013, and on November 21st, 2013, Day pled guilty to theft as provided in Utah Code Annotated 766-404, a Class A misdemeanor, which was later amended to a Class B misdemeanor. On July 30th, 2013, Day was detained for retail theft by, from a retail store. In addition, Day was found to be in possession of a drug paraphernalia which tested positive for heroin. On November 21st, 2013, Day pled guilty to possession of a controlled possession or use of controlled substance as provided in Utah Code Annotated 58-37-8, subsection 2A, Romanet 1, a third-degree felony. On August 15th, 2013, Day was arrested for retail theft from a retail store. On November 4th, 2013, Day pled guilty to retail theft as provided in Utah Code Annotated 766602, a Class B misdemeanor. And on August 30th, 2013, Day was found to be in possession of oxycodone. And on October 9th, 2013, Day pled guilty to possession or use of controlled substance as provided in Utah Code Annotated 58-37-8, subsection 2A, Romanet 1, a third-degree felony. Post attempted multiple times to contact Day to interview him regarding these convictions. Day did not contact Post to schedule an interview. As a result, Blake Day failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and on May 31st, 2014, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and sent to Mr. Day.
Okay, any questions? Is Mr. Day or a representative for Mr. Day here that would like to appear before the council? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the council for a motion. Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter for the post council is the certification of Timothy J. Brewer, former member of the Grand County Sheriff's Department. The sustained allegations are aggravated assault and assault on a peace officer, which fall under Category A of the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Post recommended disciplinary action is revocation. A summary of the facts are as follows. On July 11, 2013, Brewer unexpectedly observed his wife and his father engaged in sexual conduct. Upon seeing this, Brewer began to strike his father several times, causing substantial bodily injury. Brewer then retrieved a handgun, returned to the bedroom, and brandished the handgun. Brewer then began striking his father with the gun. Brewer's father was later taken to the hospital, and Brewer went to the hospital and caused a disturbance, demanding access to where his father was being treated. The hospital staff contacted the local police department. When the police arrived, Brewer was escorted to his house a short distance away. While at his house, Brewer attempted to walk back to the hospital. One of the responding officers stood in front of Brewer to prevent Brewer from going back to the hospital. Brewer pushed through the officer's position, making contact with the officer, and according to that officer, he received a broken tooth as a result of that contact. Brewer pled guilty to assault, a Class A misdemeanor, and assault against a peace officer, a Class A misdemeanor. On May 14, 2013, Timothy Brewer waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions? Is Mr. Brewer or a representative for Mr. Brewer here that would like to appear before council? Okay, please step to the podium, state your name for the record.
Nate Nelson appearing on behalf of T.J. Brewer. Before my client addresses this body, I'd like to...
What was your last name?
Nelson, N-E-L-S-O-N.
And you're his attorney?
Yes.
Okay, so you all have 20 minutes.
Okay. Before my client addresses this body, I'd like to take a few minutes to make some comments on his behalf. Given the tragic and extreme circumstances that he was confronted with on July 12th of 2013, his actions were not extreme or outrageous. Which one of us, finding our wife sleeping with our father, would not have acted in a similar manner? Which one of us would have acted with more restraint? Should Officer Brewer be punished for his actions? Yes. But should his certification be revoked? No. Officer Brewer has a 12-and-a-half-year history with no blemishes whatsoever in law enforcement. Not long ago, this body considered how it should discipline an officer who struck a juvenile who was in handcuffs. That officer had recently learned that that juvenile had sexually abused his child. This body made a determination that based on the extreme circumstances that that officer found himself in at the time, that he acted with as much restraint as was humanly possible. That officer retained his certification. We are asking this body for the same determination and for the same result, that Brewer was faced with extreme and extraordinary circumstances, that he acted with as much restraint as was humanly possible. We're asking, you know, suspend him for 3 years, make him go back to the police academy, but stop short of revoking his certification. And with that, I'll turn the time over to my client for a few comments.
I just want to say thank you for a moment of your time. I've regretted every day since this incident has happened that I went and walked upstairs and saw what I saw. I'm willing to accept what I did, and I regret it every day since. I was honest during the investigation. I felt like during my years of service as a law enforcement officer, I had a lot of pride and integrity. I loved doing what I was doing. I would love to continue it someday. I just throw myself at your mercy. I apologize for what I've done. I've apologized to everybody involved. I apologize that we're here talking about it today. I never thought I'd see myself here. This is the second worst day of my life. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
And with that, we would submit it to council.
All right, Mr. Yockey.
Just some minor clarification. The difference between Mr. Brewer and the former individual that was disciplined is that the former individual was never charged or convicted with any offenses. In this matter, we have two Class A convictions with violence.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Yockey.
And that's with that we submit.
Okay, now I'll bring it back to the post council. Any questions? Sheriff Edmonds, discussion's fine.
You know, I've struggled with this case. There's no question that Deputy Brewer at the time saw something that was absolutely outrageous. And there's no doubt in my mind that his actions at the house that day were justified. I believe that practically anybody would have done similar at the house. Where Mr. Brewer loses me is when he goes back to the hospital. And there was something about, there was a statement made, I believe it was in the report, but I'm having a hard time finding it right now. And if we can, I'd like to get some clarification from Mr. Brewer. Why, the statement that was attributed to you as you were going back to the hospital to, quote, finish the job, is that correct?
No. Would you like me to?
Yeah, bro, if you mind.
Yeah.
I said a lot that night, you know, and I was surrounded by my brothers, law enforcement officers. You know, there was one officer that I was hitting him on the chest, and he was hugging me, and he's like, let it go, let it go. The things that I said that night were inappropriate, absolutely, but my intentions weren't to go back and do harm. I can't dispute that I said that or not, but my intentions were never to go back there. I was at an intersection walking down the road when my mom pulled up and said, your dad has stabbed himself and he's at the hospital. That's what drew me to the hospital. I did go and knock on, I banged on the window. I was emotionally distraught. I wasn't there to finish the job. If that was the case, I would have done it at the house. I had no plans of hurting him further. When my mom told me that, she said, he's dying. He's not going to make it. So.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So when you went back to the hospital, to the best of your recollection, why did you go back? What were you trying to do? What was your intent?
The first time, or?
You went back to the hospital.
I only went one time.
If I could quickly interject. Post counsel, the facts stipulated to, this is just to protect the appeals process and whatnot. But in order to protect this, we need to stick with the facts. We've already had, he's already waived to the facts in the notice of agency action. So we would request that you stick to those facts and not ask additional questions to the client. To the...
I never made it back to the hospital the second time. I only went one time.
The facts of the case, Chairman, this is 22, is that when you returned to the hospital, the police had to be called and we assaulted an uncle.
Yeah.
And the police heard you make the statement that, well, finish the job at the hospital. So
my uncle is also, he's a deputy there at the sheriff's office. And he came out and said, you're not going in there. And we had some words and stuff like that.
Is he the same one that was in Burlington Q?
No, that was a city police officer.
So there's two different people at the hospital?
That was at the house. The city police officer was at the house.
Chair?
There's no doubt that this is an extreme case. Again, I've struggled with it ever since I heard about it initially. And then after reading the reports, I'm very conflicted on it. What a horrible, horrible thing. I can't imagine anything. Well, there are a few things more horrible in this case. It's one of the worst ones I think we've seen since I've been on the council. Again, my opinion is, had he stopped at the house, I probably would be the first one adamantly banging on the table to give him an opportunity to come back with his confession. But considering the circumstances and how it progressed and escalated, I'm reticent to do that. Are we entertaining motions?
Well, if there's more discussion, we'll take the discussion first. Commissioner Gibson.
One comment. Had some similar feelings as you expressed. And I don't know if this is one of those things you weren't supposed to hear or not, but my understanding from what was just said is that when you returned to the hospital, the request of his mother, who saw him on the street, and told him that his father had been stabbed. To me, that makes it a little different than returning to the hospital with the intent of harming his father. I'm not sure exactly what the rest of the circumstances. You asked a question that made me think that you may not have understood what I understood, so I'm hoping that I heard the same.
Any other discussion? Okay, at this point, we'll bring it to the council for a motion. Okay, Ms. Morin. Okay, 4-year suspension would require Mr. Brewer to return to the police academy and undergo the entire block of law enforcement training. Any discussion on the motion? Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Mr. Leo, Lucy seconds. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Any opposed?
Opposed.
Okay, we'll do a show of hands. All in favor raise your hand. All opposed to the motion, raise your hands. Six to five. Motion passes 6-5. 4-year suspension. You will be required to return to the police academy if you want to enter law enforcement again. Go ahead, Mr. Yockey.
The next matter before the council is the certification of Jonathan Tesh, former member of the Weber County Sheriff's Office. The sustained allegations are sexual conduct while on duty, which falls under Category B of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended discipline action is a 3-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On or about August 6, 2013, Jonathan Tesh engaged in sexual conduct while on duty. Tesh subsequently admitted to the sexual conduct to his agency, and an internal investigation was initiated. Tesh admitted in Garrity interviews with both Weber County Sheriff's Office and Post that he engaged in sexual conduct while on duty. Tesh resigned from the Weber County Sheriff's Office on August 30, 2013. And on June 3rd, 2014, Jonathan Tesh waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions, Mr. Yockey? Is Mr. Tesh here, or a representative of Mr. Tesh, like to address the council? Okay, please step forward and state your name for the record.
Good morning, Council. My name is Jonathan Tesh. I'm humbled to be here in front of you, this council, this morning. And I appreciate your time and dedication to your service in your different agencies. At this time, am I able to speak?
Okay. Your turn.
Just a little background on myself. I've been a veteran of the Weber County Sheriff's Office for 17 years. I've been an exemplary officer through those years as a correctional officer in the jail. Also, I've been a reserve for Ogden City for 18 years. And I've dedicated my entire life, half of my entire life, to law enforcement. And in the time since August, I've gone through a lot of difficulties, a lot of loss, but I've also learned from this experience. And I will continue to learn. And throughout my career, I've accomplished many things, as much as you have accomplished in your different careers as well, and I'm sure. And I am indeed dedicated to serving in law enforcement. And I ask the council to take that in consideration, that I will learn from this experience and that I will grow from this experience. And I'm grateful for this opportunity to go through this experience, to learn, and to be a better officer and be a dedicated person, not only in law enforcement, but in my family life, my home life, my spiritual life. I have been recently rehired with the Sheriff's Office, with full support of the sheriff and my coworkers. And I'm grateful for that. And I look forward to the day that I become rehired with the Weber County Sheriff's Office. And I ask the council to be lenient on what the sanction may be. And whatever the sanction is, I'm accepting, and I take full responsibility of my actions, and they were my actions alone. And I submit and humbly submit this to the council.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tesh. Any questions? Mr. Yockey?
Nothing in rebuttal.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Commissioner?
I am a Weber County Commissioner, so this individual works for Weber County, so I just want to put that on the record. And also say that I don't know him from Adam. I've never met Mr. Tesh, to my knowledge. Certainly, I certainly don't know him other than now that I see his face, I may have seen him somewhere. So that's the extent of our relationship. However, I do, I have read the information and I have studied the letter from Sheriff Thompson that's in the packet. And I would just like to submit that Sheriff Thompson views this indiscretion as serious, but yet an anomaly of character for this individual. And moreover, he sees some mitigating circumstances, including in the third paragraph of the letter, he mentions that if this individual had not been completely honest in bringing the violation to the sheriff's attention, we may have never known the circumstances surrounding the behavior. And so I feel like with those mitigating circumstances, I would like to see us consider a recommendation of an 18-month suspension, which is the minimum in this category. So that's my recommendation based upon what I've seen presented and the information presented by the sheriff. So I'd like to recommend that we do that. If you'd like me to do that in the form of a motion, I will. But that's my recommendation.
Yes. So what we were talking about was that if there was a potential for a conflict of interest, but
and that's why
you're a county commissioner and Mr. Tesh is employed by the county sheriff. Completely separate elected official, we do not feel that there's any conflict of interest in this matter.
And that's why I explained the extent of my relationship at the beginning. I hope that was clear.
Thank you. We appreciate that, Commissioner. Any other discussion?
I'd like to just ask why Post recommended the 3 years, what their justification was.
Okay. It's just on the
Mr. Yockey, you get the Post under the Post disciplinary. If you look at the Post disciplinary guidelines,
That's in your packet. It sexual conduct while on duty does fall under the category B, which is a our guideline is three-year suspension.
If I could answer your question, we want to stay consistent with the baseline. That's what we've historically researched, and that's how we came up with the guideline. So to deviate to the good or to increase the top end of the suspension, I believe we have to have justifiable grounds to do so from our staff. Keeping in mind that the council has adopted the guidelines, however, it's not a binding document. So that's why we will stick with the baseline unless there's a mitigating or aggravating circumstance.
And just as a suggestion, if you were contemplating a deviating from the guideline or the baseline, it might be good just to state for the record what mitigating, or and if there's a case where it's an aggravating, what mitigating circumstance you feel justifies that.
Well, my question is, according to the facts of the case, Mr. Tesh disclosed this to Weber County SO after being contacted by the husband of the other party. So to me, that raises the question of, you go turn yourself in, or I'm going to go turn yourself in. That's what I'm speculating occurred, which would then mitigate some of the mitigating circumstances.
That's the question I was going to ask.
why did he wait? Like you said, was it because I got caught or because I wanted to do the right thing?
Mr. Chairman, the difference that I saw there is it seems to me that you're correct in that he was approached by the husband, but from my reading of the document, including the letter from the sheriff, it was approached in more of a general term that you had had sex with my wife, but a lot of the details, including the sex while on duty, was information that was brought forth voluntarily that, as the sheriff states, he may have not known the details, including the on-duty portion, without the forthrightness of the officer. So, that's the way I saw the coming forward with additional information.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. May I speak for a second? Or is it? Go ahead, Mr. Tesh.
I just wanted to clarify that as well, is that the circumstances of the affair were, yes, I did, contact because of my employer, but the affair, the sexual conduct on duty was, I had a choice whether to disclose that or not. My integrity and my honesty and in my heart, I knew that I had to come forward with that sexual activity that one time, and that's why it came forth, and that's where that is coming from, where the sheriff put that out there in that letter, and that's where I feel that me as a person, I think I made the right choice in disclosing everything and being true and forthright in this with the investigation with the sheriff's office as well as here at Post.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chester. I'm just reminding council that we should probably keep in mind several circumstances that we've had
in the past in these type of incidences and consistency that we've attempted to maintain throughout those processes, considering both mitigating and aggravating circumstances. So with that, Colonel?
Chair, I'll have to recuse myself in this case because I know of the party that was involved in this was from my department, and the investigation is in my mind, so I know all the details of that, which I'm incorporating into this, so I'll just recuse myself and not vote on this.
Okay, thank you, Colonel. Okay, any other discussion? And
seeing none, we'll bring it back to the council for a motion.
Sheriff Edmonds?
I make the motion that we accept Post's recommendation.
Okay. Motion to accept. Do we have a second?
I second that.
Mr. Chair,
Checkets?
I'd like to make a substitute motion then, if that's appropriate. Substitute motion.
Go ahead.
A substitute motion would be that we go with the year and a half suspension with the because of the mitigating circumstances as outlined in the sheriff's letter that I referred to earlier, that we go with the 1.5 year suspension. 18-month suspension.
We have a substitute motion of 18 months. Discussion on the motion. Substitute motion. Do we have a second?
I second.
Okay, I guess we'll vote on the substitute motion first. By a show of hands, all in favor of the substitute motion, please raise your hand. All opposed, please raise your hand. Substitute motion fails. We're now back to the original motion. All in favor of Sheriff Edmonds' motion to adopt staff's recommendation, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Tesh.
The next matter for the Council is the certification of Rodney Hodson, former member of the San Pete County Sheriff's Department. The sustained allegations are assault, which falls under Category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action
is a two-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On June 25, 2013, Rodney Hodson slapped a female patient's face. Hodson, who was employed part-time as an emergency medical technician, responded to the patient's residence for a medical emergency. The patient was non-compliant and was using abrasive language. Hodson became offended at the language and slapped the patient on the face. The patient was restrained on a medical gurney at the time of the assault. During an interview with Post, Hodson admitted to slapping the female patient's face while she was restrained on the gurney. He entered into a plea in advance by pleading guilty to assault, a Class B misdemeanor. On March 24, 2014, Rodney Hodson waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions from the council?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Was he charged for assault?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. He was charged with assault and did plead guilty to a Class B misdemeanor plea in advance.
Is Mr. Hodson, the representative of Mr. Hodson, here this morning? Okay, bring it back to council. Any further discussion? And we'll take a motion.
Move to accept.
Second. Okay. Get that, John. Okay, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter for the council is certification of Jamie L. Olson. The sustained allegations are assault and public intoxication, which falls under Category C of the Post-Council Disciplinary Guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a two-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On April 28, 2013, Jamie Olson was arrested for assaulting a man in a bar. Witnesses stated Olson came into the bar and using his right arm, which was in a cast, struck a male patron on the top of his head. The man sustained a laceration to his head and was transported to a local hospital. During questioning by police, Olson admitted to striking the man. Olson was charged criminally with assault and public intoxication and entered a guilty plea to both charges to be held in abeyance. Olson failed to respond to the notice of agency action, and on April 22, 2014, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge and mailed to Olson.
Any questions? Is Mr. Olson a representative here today? And okay, bring it back to the council for a motion.
Second.
Okay, motion to accept it on a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter for the council is certification of Tracy Jensen, former member of the Syracuse Police Department. Sustained allegations are falsify or alter a government record, which falls under Category D of the Post-Council Disciplinary Guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 18-month suspension. Summary of the facts are as follows. On February 6, 2013, Tracy Jensen crashed a Syracuse Police Department motorcycle he was not authorized to ride. The following day, Jensen filed a workers' compensation claim, which stated Jensen slipped and fell on ice, injuring his back. An internal affairs investigation was opened when it was discovered that Jensen had crashed the motorcycle, failed to report it, and falsified his workers' compensation form. Jensen resigned from the Syracuse Police Department before the internal investigation was complete. Syracuse Police Department referred the investigation to the local county attorney's office for possible criminal charges. During the criminal investigation, Jensen claimed he slipped and fell on ice earlier in the shift prior to crashing the motorcycle. Jensen was vague about the time and location of the fall, but claimed it was during a traffic stop. The investigator was unable to corroborate Jensen's story after searching the police dash cam video from that evening. In a subsequent interview, Jensen admitted to the fall occurred on a traffic stop at a different location, and a stop was recorded but did not document that fall. Jensen was charged with falsifying a government record and entered into a guilty plea to the Class B misdemeanor. On May 8, 2014, Jensen waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions? Is Mr. Jensen or a representative from Mr. Jensen here this morning? No? OK, Okay, back to council for a motion.
Chairman, I just point out to the council members that there is a letter in your packet from the chief of Syracuse that came to us late and was not able to be emailed out.
A few moments will allow you to read the letter. Chief Acton. Okay, we'll back. Okay, Dr. Budd's made a motion to accept.
Do I have a second? A lot of doctors on the post council.
Yes, we are.
Nobody. That's a good thing.
Hey, we have a motion. Sheriff Evans.
Can I make a substitute motion?
Yes.
I make the substitute motion that we amend. Reject post recommendation, amend it to a 2-year suspension as requested by the chief. I think he makes some compelling arguments there.
Okay. We have a substitute motion. We have a second of the substitute motion. We have discussion on the substitute motion.
I think these, I just withdraw my motion.
Okay. Dr. Butters will put on his.
Dave Evans is convinced.
He is very convincing. All right. We'll now take a vote on the substitute motion of a 2-year suspension. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. 2-year suspension.
The next matter is the certification of Jason C. Golightly. The sustained allegations are driving under the influence and driving on a suspended license. An open container in a motor vehicle, which falls under Category D and E of the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is 18-month suspension based on the multiple violations. Summary of the facts are as follows. On September 16, 2012, Jason Golightly was stopped for a window tint violation. During the traffic stop, it was discovered Golightly had consumed alcohol and had an unsealed bottle of liquor in the passenger compartment of the vehicle. Golightly performed the standardized field sobriety test, which indicated no signs of impairment. Golightly submitted to a portable breath test, which indicated his breath alcohol content was above 0.08. Golightly was arrested for an open container and transported to the county jail, where he submitted to an intoxilizer test. The intoxilizer test indicated Golightly had a breath alcohol content of 0.082. Golightly was booked into jail for open container. The charge of driving under the influence was later added by the county attorney. On October 16, 2012, Golightly pled no contest to driving under the influence, a Class B misdemeanor. The charge of open container was dismissed. Then on December 1, 2012, Golightly was stopped for speeding. During the course of the traffic stop, it was discovered that Golightly's driver license was suspended. Golightly was issued a citation for speeding and driving on a suspended driver's license. On January 22, 2013, Golightly pled guilty to a driving on a suspended driver's license, a Class B misdemeanor. On June 3, 2014, Jason Golightly waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts contained in the notice of agency action.
Okay, any questions? Is Mr. Golightly here, or a representative of Mr. Golightly? No? Okay, bring it back to council for discussion. Any further discussion? We have a motion. Sheriff Tracy moves to accept. A second.
Director Cook, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter is the certification of Larry Carver, former member of the Syracuse Police Department. The sustained allegation is a BCI violation, which falls under Category E of the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a 1-year suspension based on the multiple violations. A summary of the facts are as follows. Between September 6, 2013 and September 12, 2013, Larry Carver accessed Bureau of Criminal Identification records for personal reasons. During a Syracuse Police Department internal investigation, Carver admitted he accessed BCI records while off duty to acquire the marital status of two female police cadets. Criminal charges are pending. Carver was terminated on October 1st, 2013, and on June 3rd, 2014, Carver waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
I take it from this that criminal charges were never filed?
They are pending as of right now. We do not have...
Last I heard, they are still pending. Davis County's got to do that case.
Thank you. You'll note that there's a letter from Chief Atkin in your packet. Take a few minutes to allow you time to review its contents. Okay, in the past we have considered some mitigating circumstances on this when an individual perhaps runs a family member. In this instance, we have an officer that accessed BCI records for what appears to me to be arranging dates with police academy students, which is clearly an unauthorized use of the BCI records, and I don't necessarily agree with Chief Atkin's request for a lighter sentence. This, regardless, he was terminated on 10-1, so this will take effect. This would last till when, Director Stevenson? When was this dated?
He was terminated 10-1-13, and so a year and a half.
So 1 year. 1 year. 1 year.
10-1. So we're coming up on that in a fairly short period of time. So that's my read on it. Is Mr. Carver here this morning? Or representative Mr. Carver? No? Okay, bring it back to council. Any discussion? Do we have a motion?
Motion to accept 1 year.
Thank you. Second by Chief Tracy, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
The next matter before the Post Council is the certification of Robert Wallace, former member of the Utah Department of Corrections. Sustained allegations are electronic communications harassment and disorderly conduct, which falls under Category D and C of the Post Council Disciplinary Guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a one-year suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On May 12, 2012, Robert W. Wallace engaged in texting conversation with the ex-husband of the wife of his wife. During the texting, Wallace threatened to physically assault the ex-husband if he ever came to Wallace's property. Wallace also threatened to shoot the ex-husband in the head if Wallace was in the mood. The ex-husband reported the threats to the local police department, who conducted an investigation. During an interview with Wallace, the threats were corroborated. Wallace was charged with disorderly conduct and electronic communications harassment. On July 12, 2012, Wallace entered into a plea of guilty to a charge of disorderly conduct, and the electronic communications charge was dismissed. On March 22, 2013, Post conducted a Garrity interview with Wallace. Wallace admitted he engaged in text messaging with the ex-husband, during which Wallace threatened to physically assault and shoot the ex-husband. On September 22, 2013, Officer Robert Wallace waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions? Is Mr. Wallace here this morning, or a representative from Mr. Wallace? No? Okay, back to the council.
Mr. Chairman, I'm recusing myself from the vote.
Thank you, Director. Motion to accept by Mr. Lucy. Do I have a second? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
The next matter before the council is certification of Wesley Morger, current member of the Utah Department of Corrections. Sustained allegations are taking protected wildlife, which falls under Category E of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a letter of caution based on the nature of the offense. A summary of the facts are as follows. On January 17, 2014, Wesley Morger was ice fishing. Morger caught and kept five fish, exceeding the legal limit of four fish. Morger stated he was catching fish in quick succession and did not realize he had kept one too many fish. Morger was issued a citation by a local police officer for exceeding the daily bag and possession limit for fish, a Class B misdemeanor. Morger pled guilty to the amended charge of disorderly conduct and infraction, and on April 30, 2014, Wesley Morger waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in notice of agency action.
Any questions? Sheriff?
We have two counts here. Why is this one done then?
So initially he was charged with exceeding the daily bag limit, and the prosecutor reduced that and amended the charge down to disorderly conduct. An infraction.
Mr. Morgan here this morning.
Rest with the council, sir.
Excuse me. First off, I'd like to apologize for even being here. I've fished and hunted my whole life. I don't break the law. I don't have these kind of violations. It was a heat of the moment kind of deal. I had made a pole holder fish catcher mouse trap kind of deal. I had a two pole permit. The mouse trap was working. I'd caught several fish. Had them on the ice. I'd released a fish or two. At the point where I had the fifth fish, I had a fish on. I fought it to the hole. As I was bringing it out of the hole, my other pole started bouncing. I'd caught another fish. I released the fish. I took the fish. Took the hook out. I slid it on the ice, and I ran over and got the other pole. I brought that fish up, released it, and put it down the hole. Went back, sat. Me and my buddy were talking. I was excited about the mouse trap working. I wasn't paying attention how many fish I actually had on the ice. 15-20 minutes later, an officer approached me. Didn't know he was an officer. He came up. As he was approaching us, and the other pole started going off again. I went over and was fighting a fish there. He come up. He asked us how we were doing, said it looked like we did pretty good. He asked me what the score was. At that point, I could see he was standing next to four fish on one side of him and one fish by his left foot, which gave me a total of five. I knew my buddy hadn't caught any fish. I told the officer the score is 5-0. He acknowledged that. He asked me for my ID and my fishing license, at which time I gave him that. While I was talking to him, I brought that other fish in that I had. I released it down the hole while I was talking to the officer. And he took my identification, left, came back later, and gave me the citation. I went to the Paiute County Courthouse, went through the hearing with the judge and stuff. The judge asked me why I didn't tell the officer the two of the fish were my buddies. I told the officer that, or I told the judge, explained to the judge that the officers were within 40 yards of us. We'd been fishing together for probably 2 hours. They were aware that I was catching the fish, and I wasn't going to lie to the officer. At that point in time, he asked the deputy that was there some questions. The deputy said, yeah, that it was an issue, that I was held to a higher standard. He asked me about how I pled, and I told him, if I plead guilty to this, it could influence my or affect my certification. The judge was concerned. He asked the officer about it and asked me where I worked, and I told him that I was employed with the Department of Corrections. He asked me then why I didn't tell the officer that two of the fish were my buddies. And that's how that went. I told them I wasn't going to lie to the officer. I could see the five fish. Didn't realize I had the five fish. I told the officer the score's 5-0, and then he did what he did. The judge also asked me at that point in time why I didn't let the officer know I was an officer with the Department of Corrections. I told him that I wasn't going to try and buy my way out of a ticket, that would even be worse than you know, trying to make my buddy the accessory in this incident. It wasn't intentional. There was no criminal intent. There was no malice. It was just a heat of the moment thing. It was a mistake. And like I say, I apologize for even being here. I don't do these kind of things. That's all I got to say.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mortar. Any questions for counsel?
Director Stevenson, would you like to address the counsel? Just in case there's a question of why recommending a letter of caution for a Class B misdemeanor. Remember, we broke out the Class B category for these types of situations so that in a situation like this, we can reach a letter of caution.
Any discussion? Entertain a motion?
Motion to accept.
Motion to accept. Do you have a second?
Mr. Chair, I need to recuse myself.
I thought you would.
Sorry. Director. Yeah. I'll second.
Sure. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Letter of caution. Next matter before the council is the certification of Lawrence G. McCandless,
a current officer with the Utah State Hospital Police Department. The sustained allegations are electronic communications harassment, which falls under Category E of the post-council disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended disciplinary action is a letter of caution based on the nature of the offense. A summary of the facts are as follows. On December 21st, 2013, McCandless went to the home of his ex-mother-in-law in an attempt to pick up his 6-year-old daughter for his visitation day. McCandless had received a text message from his ex-mother-in-law stating his daughter was sick and he could not have her. McCandless knocked on the door of the residence, noted that it was obvious someone was inside and not answering the door. McCandless returned to the car and tried to contact his ex-mother-in-law by phone, but she did not answer. McCandless stated he made the comment, "You fucking phony," as he was hanging up the phone and did not realize the remark was recorded on her voice message. The ex-mother-in-law signed a complaint against McCandless, and he was charged criminally with electronic communications harassment, a Class B misdemeanor. McCandless appeared in court and entered a plea of no contest to the reduced charge of electronic communications harassment, an infraction. On June 2nd, 2014, Lawrence McCandless waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Okay, any questions? Is Officer McCandless here? No? Okay, bring it back to council for discussion. Any discussion?
Have a motion to accept. Do we have a second?
Sure. Chair Peppermans.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Any opposed?
Please continue. The next matter before the council is the certification of Christopher A. Rea, current member of the Division of Wildlife Resources. Sustained allegations are unlawful taking of protected wildlife, which falls under Category E of the post-disciplinary guidelines. The recommended post-disciplinary action is a letter of caution based on the nature of the offense. Summary of the facts are as follows. On September 30th, 2013, Christopher Rea was hunting a buck mule deer during the designated muzzle loader hunt while off-duty. Rea accidentally shot and killed a doe after mistaking it for a buck. Rea immediately contacted his supervisor and reported the incident. The Division of Wildlife Resources conducted an investigation which corroborated Rea's report. The case was referred to the county attorney. Rea entered into a guilty plea to be held in abeyance to the charge of unlawful taking of protected wildlife, a Class B misdemeanor. Post considered the fact that Rea immediately self-reported the incident as a mitigating factor in its recommendation of a letter of caution. On May 5, 2014, Christopher Rea waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Yockey. Any questions with Mr. Yockey? Is Mr. Rea here this morning?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to address the council?
Thank you for a few minutes this morning. I just wanted to address the council and let them know this was truly an accident on my part. I had no intentions of violating any law, and it's been somewhat humbling for me and somewhat embarrassing for me as well to go through this process. However, as stated, I did immediately report this to my supervisor, knowing that a mistake was made, that it was an accident, and I wanted to do my part to rectify the situation and accept responsibility for anything that would come forward from that. That's all I've got. Thanks.
Mr. Ray, did you receive any discipline from your department?
No, there was no agency action, no.
Okay. Thank you. Director Cook?
First of all, I truly appreciate your honesty calling your supervisor. It says a ton about you. It truly does. And mostly this is just some discussion because I just have some concerns here. We got a situation where this could happen to a lot of our folks that work in different agencies. And I just hope that we're consistent if we decide that we're going to go with the letter of caution, because I have a lot of hunters that could make the same mistake. And I just want us to make sure, and I don't know, I'm fairly new to the council, I apologize, I don't have all that knowledge, that this is consistent with what we've done in the past. Again, as a hunter myself, 100 yards, you binoculared it, and then you shot it. And I know if you rolled up on me, if I'd done the same thing, it'd definitely be a big question. I don't know if I'm just saying from a discussion standpoint, I just want to make sure we're consistent because it won't be the last time we're here facing this issue. And I'm just concerned of just saying it's a letter of caution when we've taken a big game animal. That's all I got.
Sheriff Smith, do you have comments?
I do. We've had this... My department's had this same conversation with Fish and Game, and and I feel a little bit different. I commend this officer for doing exactly what he did. There has been a lot of people that would push that animal under a rock and walk away. And the thing that the discussion we had with the Fish and Game was that if we can't come to if there was no intent, no malice, this might be a case of malice where he should have known better, maybe bad shot or bad sight, one of the two. But there's got to be an avenue. If you turn yourself in for making a mistake, and as this officer did in reading this, he also cleaned, dressed the meat, brought it to his supervisor, marked his tag, lost his hunt, lost the deer. He has already lost, some of what he started out to do. And I would rather see this type of action happen than promote a situation where somebody, knowing they're going to come off the hill, if they call their supervisor, if they call a Fish and Game, is going to get a citation, is going to do that, so they're not going to take the chance. They'll just discard the animal. We kind of had a discussion with that last year with Fish and Game, and they agreed that they need to come really think about issuing a citation on the situation where they turned themselves in, if it was actually a mistake. Just a comment.
Any other comments?
That's the question. Does anybody know what would happen in the courts if a civilian did the same thing? I'm not familiar with hunting, so I'm just kind of curious.
Attention.
What would happen to a civilian if the same thing happened?
They probably get cited.
Do the courts take this into consideration if they approach the officer and turn themselves in?
I would assume that most courts would.
I'm not 100, so I'm just kind of curious.
I know, if I may, I know in talking to the director at DNR, he said that they are going to train their officers more in discretion, so they cannot. I mean, they're not required to issue a citation. They can hear the facts, and they can choose whether to write a citation or not. Have you heard that in your training?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I think we might be getting out a little bit from the facts of the case, so we need to bring it back. Any more discussion on this? Commissioner?
My comment is just, I think I agree with Sheriff Smith. I don't know, frankly, what a letter of caution does in your file, but what kind of a detrimental effect that may have in the future for this individual. But I will say that it seems to me, from everything that I've read here, again, that he did everything appropriately after having what I would consider to be an accident. I mean, to me, it's similar to a fender bender on a freeway where you didn't do anything wrong, but you had a fender bender, and then you took appropriate action afterwards to remedy that accident. And so I think it makes, I'm concerned about any punishment here, because I think it was an accident he then handled appropriately. So I can support the letter of caution if that doesn't have negative impact in the future. I worry. I think what we want to have happen, as Sheriff Edmonds described, is when a situation like this occurs, where an accident happens, that then we appropriate action is taken by the individual to make sure that he harvests and takes the proper steps afterwards. And it seems like that's what was done here in this case.
I think there's one factor that has not been brought up, however, in this discussion. And I don't necessarily disagree, but the uniform that he's wearing this morning is that of a wildlife resource officer. I would certainly expect him to do exactly what he did, be because he's one of their officers. He knew what should happen. And this is, we're not dealing with a run-of-the-mill citizen that's out in the hills and erroneously shoots a deer. We're dealing with somebody that's, his career is the management of our wildlife resources throughout the state. And that's, this is, I'm sorry, but this is not mitigating circumstances to me. I would expect one of my officers to self-report if they violate the law.
And Chairman, just for some clarification, a letter of caution in the individual's record for post at least would be considered an aggravating factor if additional charges were brought later on.
Thank you.
One
question.
Sure.
Is there an expiration date on that? Does it stay in there permanently? Can you request that it be taken out at some future date?
No.
It's permanent.
It's permanent.
Can I make a motion for no action?
I think we have a few more
discussions. Yeah, I don't know if it's appropriate, so stop me if it's not. But just for consistency's sake, we just had a case in front of us for a fifth fish sitting on the ice. And it, from what I heard and read, that officer also accepted responsibility. Probably had it way out if he wanted to use it, didn't choose to. We didn't have a lot of discussion about him getting a letter of caution. This officer works in very law enforcement and enforces the law that he violated, and we're concerned about whether he's going to have a letter of caution in his file. So that's just for point of reference. All right.
Sure,
you know, I think the letter of the letter of a caution is appropriate, just from the standpoint that it's documented, it's in the file. It's not going to adversely affect his career. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to preclude him from promotion or anything like that. So I don't have a problem with that. I do want to get back to what Director Cook said, though. I think we do need to be cautious and make sure that we aren't, you know, engaging in disparate treatment. If we have a officer from Layton that does the same thing, then we should definitely look into and make sure that our punishment is similar to that. And there have been times where we've had big game animals taken and they've come before this body that, you know, there's a lot of hemming and hawing, I think, with the group. But this is, I think his actions were appropriate. I think he did everything right. But I like the fact that it's documented, because if something like this were to happen again in the future, we've got this now as a letter of caution. So that's the way I see it.
Just to answer Mr. Bailey's question, not that it has bearing on this proceeding, just for context, in addition to what goes on in the criminal court, again, not that it has bearing on here, but there's also, DWR also has a adjudicative proceeding that can suspend people's hunting and fishing privileges. I know that because I used to be a hearing officer for DWR, and so that is part of the process when someone is cited to, just for context.
The only reason I ask is what, you know, the public thinking, well, he's getting off because he's an officer. If I did the same thing, I'd be going to court and, you know, paying a few hundred all the time. I agree. I think he did everything he needed to do. I was just concerned about the disparity between an officer and a civilian.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, we'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to accept.
Okay, well, a motion to accept by Sheriff Smith, second by Sheriff Tracy. Any discussion on the motion? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries.
The last matter before the council.
Mr. Yockey, before you continue, this is one of my ex-employees. So if by chance this goes to a tie vote, I'm going to turn the chair over to the vice chair, Sheriff Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. The last matter before the post council is the certification of Tracy L. Wells. She is a former member of the Layton City Police Department. Sustained allegations are unfit for duty, which falls under Category G of the post disciplinary guidelines. The post recommended disciplinary action is an indefinite suspension. A summary of the facts are as follows. On or about January 12, 2013, Layton City Police Department investigated Wells for several department policy violations. During the internal investigation, Wells' close friends committed suicide. Wells provided documentation from her attending physician establishing she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Layton City Police Department then sent Wells to an independent physician who determined Wells was not fit for duty as a peace officer. After the fitness for duty evaluation, Wells was granted 12 weeks of FMLA leave and an additional 4 weeks of unpaid leave. Wells failed to return to work at the end of the leave and moved out of state. Wells was subsequently terminated from the Layton City Police Department on June 18, 2013. And on May 21st, 2014, Tracy Wells waived her right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions, Mr. Yockey? Is Ms. Wells or a representative here this morning?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Nelson?
Nate Nelson for Tracy Wells. She would agree that her certification should be suspended indefinitely pending an ability on her part to show that she is, in fact, fit for duty. Don't anticipate that that's going to be a problem.
Okay.
Submit
that
to the council.
Okay, any discussion on council? You entertain a motion?
The board may want to decide when they craft their motion order whether they want Ms. Wells to reappear before the board, or if they want if they're fine and comfortable having her just bring the necessary documentation just to post and then be reinstated.
Okay. So the options are accept a positions. Certification that Ms. Wells is no longer suffering from PTSD and is now fit for duty, or require Ms. Wells to personally appear in front of the council along with that certification. Be able to post.
Why would we do that? Because we can't question her, right?
No, well, I only bring it up because this happened, a year or two ago. We had a situation similar to this, and
right.
There's the question about did she have to appear before the board, or should she just go through post? And I think it'd be easier just to clarify that in the order, what she has to do with being stated. That's all.
Sure. I have one question. What initiated part of this was some violation of the policy. Were these substantial? That was all moved to. I guess what I'm asking is, like in court, when you have a mental illness and everything's postponed until you have competency again, is the issue that was driving this to begin with something that would have been of a nature that there would have been a severe sanction imposed based on a continuance of the hearing had this not gone to a FMLA issue?
I don't think we can blend that because it's not in the record, sure.
The reason I'm asking that is that whether she comes back before this audience or not, as a condition of reinstatement for fitness for duty, that was my point.
I understand. Since it's not in the record, right. I can't
go ahead.
Which is frustrating, I know, but it protects the rights of the employee as well as the post council of the state.
Can I make a motion?
Well, if I could let Mr. Nelson know something. Regarding the indefinite suspension, she's still under the provisions of the time frame. So she's out 18 months. She needs to reactivate her certification. If she's out 4 years, she still needs to come back to duty again. I just want to make sure that you're aware of that.
Yes, I understand.
Just a clarification. She's still employed?
No.
So she's terminated one way or the other from Layton City.
Correct.
I would make a motion that if she provides fitness for duty to post, that they are able to act on that. And if the fitness for duty, if they find out after the fact that the fitness for duty was based on other violations of the law, that it be brought to post council for us to hear those cases.
Second that.
Sure. Would you second it? Any discussion on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, gentlemen. Brings us to our next meeting. Our next agenda item is our next meeting, probably will be in conjunction with the sheriffs.
We can do that.
Since September.
We have the dates.
Sheriff, do we have dates?
I don't.
September.
It's the end. Yeah.
Usually the last week.
Yeah.
22nd through the 24th or 5th, it looks like. That's what I have.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think it's the week of the 22nd. I think that's what it is.
I think that's what it is. It's the week of the 22nd.
Usually end on the on the Wednesday at the round table on the 24th.
Yes.
Do you want to keep it on that day, or do you want to do it on a Monday?
We always have a hard time getting back, don't we?
We have to run between
our meetings. Yes.
That's right.
Or do it on a Thursday.
Or we could do it on a Thursday the following.
That would make them still more.
Yeah. I would be more inclined to keep it on the Wednesday. Or just we could make it one instead of noon. That would probably be helpful.
Okay.
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock would be very.
Is that here?
Down at St. George.
So, do you want lunch at 1 o'clock and begin the meeting at 2? Because we usually do lunch at noon and begin the meeting at 1.
We can start the meeting at 1 and we just don't make lunch.
That's the 24th, right?
Yes, Wednesday, 24th.
24th, St. George, and location to be announced. We have it in a park outside. That'd be the first in history.
Be like Shakespeare in the park.
Yeah, we'll take a motion, Jared. Second, somewhere.
Okay.